Hi, and welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we talk about topics related to fundraising, leadership, coaching, and management. And I'm Janice Cunning. I'm here with my partner, Margaret, and we're excited to have two guests today. One who's a returning guest, Maria Yurikova, who's been with us on the podcast before, and then Tanya Rumble is also joining us. And they are good friends and great collaborators. And like, if you don't know them by now, you probably will soon, because they seem to be on every podcast and writing for every magazine and blog post going. And they're both experienced fundraisers who are really passionate about being advocates for equity, diversity, and inclusion in the nonprofit sector. So welcome, you two.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. So I read your blog, and what I loved to start with is that you sort of named this thing that people are scared to have these conversations, that the nonprofits that you have spoken with and the directors have so much fear. So I'd love to just ask you to just tell us a little bit about what you're observing in the world.
I think that there's like a heightened sensitivity over the last decade, but certainly that's accelerated as the social justice and racial justice uprisings in North America have taken place. And I think people are really nervous about saying the wrong things. And I think similarly, a lot of folks feel like they don't have the adequate vocabulary to engage meaningfully in the discussions related to EDI or equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I think when people have seen that there's been also a lot of call out culture and cancel culture, folks are even more fearful. So I think that there's a real sensitivity to like joining a conversation and saying the wrong thing that we've definitely observed. And I think for us, you know, our key message in the blog, I think, was one of like overcome those fears. Like that comes from a place of fear, a place of scarcity, a place of expecting perfection. But the reality is that like EDI is ultimately about people and communities, and it's messy work, and it's not, there's no perfection. And frankly, I don't know that even if you have a PhD in equity studies or inclusion, that you're ever done learning about this work. So I don't think any of us are ever going to be 100% equipped to have these conversations, because they're so nuanced and they're about people's identities. So I think for us, you know, we lean into these conversations because we want to be part of it and moving it forward rather than scared of saying the wrong thing. And I think there's also like a bit of a culture in philanthropy and fundraising around not really wanting to share our failures. So I think you've got cancel culture, you've got like this sort of perfectionist you know, trait in our sector. You've got people feeling inadequate language to like access these conversations. And so a lot of folks are on the sidelines looking in and waiting, you know, for that perfect moment to jump in. And that moment just for a lot of people is just never going to happen. It's never going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. I have sort of a follow-up question. What do you think, just in, again, what you're seeing on the planet, what's the impact of saying nothing? Like, what do you think is the impact for nonprofits who have not yet been willing to have these conversations or speak publicly about their own journey here?
Well, I guess I can start and then I'll hand it over to Maria. I mean, saying nothing and doing nothing, I think, are two different things. Mm-hmm. So if you're saying something as it relates to what you are personally doing, I think there's a lot of validity there, and there will be a lot more tolerance too if you make mistakes. But if you're saying something only to be performative and to feel like you have to respond to X, Y, and Z tragedy, I think people smell that. And I think people, that's where you have call out culture. So, I would say, you know, if you're saying something reflects what you're doing, that's great. If your lack of saying something is because you're actually doing the work and building authentic relationships with communities so that you can respond in a genuine way, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But I think saying nothing also signals to your team and to your staff that it's not important, it's not on your radar. And so I think it's important to say something, even if saying something means we don't know what to do, but we want to do something, we're working through it. Like, it's sometimes, I think, just exposing our vulnerabilities. So saying something externally, I think, is a little different than saying nothing internally to the people that prop up your organization and are in the trenches with you each and every day. But I'd be interested, Maria, what you think in terms of, you know, is it important to even say anything?
I mean, I think it's, so I would take it one step back. And I think what's important is to do something, because I think if you are a leader of a nonprofit or any kind of organization today, and you are not paying attention to EDI, as a core strategy and a fairly disruptive force for the longevity and the survival of your organization, I think you are, sort of sentencing your organization to disappear into oblivion. I think that you do not have the option to not do anything about it. Whether you say something or not is a different story. And I think Tania gave a great example of how you can do that internally or externally, depending on what your comfort level is. But I think that's important to do something, because I can quote many, many studies and many, many trends, be it demographic, be it political, be societal, as to why this is really important to do something about. Now, in terms of internal or external, I think what I see the most in organizations is that the ones that are too quick to come out with something public without actually having done any work internally could be at a risk of sometimes facing a bit of backlash. So I would say if you feel the urge to do something and communicate externally what your values and what you're working on, I would say, you know, do a lot of consultation, make sure it's fairly authentic and that you actually have something to back it up with, so you don't end up having to be on the defensive for some of these things. But regardless of whether you decide to do something externally, I think that every leader can be in a position to have these, you know, infamous staff meetings that we've all been a part of, or whether it's a weekly blog you write to all of your staff, or just an email you write and say, hey, today is going to be a very tough day. Like, there's some stuff in the news that's just keeping all of us down. It's on my mind too. And so I understand that this is not the day that we can be chipper about our mission or whatever else is going on. And if you want to talk about it, let's talk about it. Let's forget about, you know, whatever we're planning in terms of our typical agenda items for meetings. And let's spend 20 minutes talking about how everyone is feeling about this, what you feel that we should do, and just have the conversation. It doesn't need to have an action item. I think, the least leaders can do is allow for some space for and safe space to have some of these conversations, because we don't talk about it nearly enough.
I'm just kind of, my mind is blown here, like how simple it is.
It's only been 3 minutes, Janice.
I know, but it's like, you know, when Tania, you started, like, you were like, they're saying things and doing things, and I'm like, of course, like, it seems so obvious, right? But at the same time, they are two distinctive things. And and it's like, yeah, it doesn't matter where you start, but just to kind of to parse out, I think you're so right. Like what you're saying, Maria, is like there's a way that you can say something that's more harmful, because you're coming from a place of, you know, not knowing, or, you know, trying to do something just for the sake of doing something rather than doing, like, having any pause, take a breath, you know, start doing things and then say something. So I just think that's really so interesting. And one of the things I loved about what you wrote was, like, there was some really practical things, you know, because the two of you sort of said, like, this can seem overwhelming because it is like, this is not going to change quickly. And yet at the same time, it's like, we have to start somewhere. And, you know, sometimes just in coaching, we'll say to people, like, just get into action, because when you actually start to do things and you learn and you grow and you can do better, right? So one of the things that the two of you talked about was this idea of, like you need to reach out to different communities as the fundraising organization, and also hold on to those donors that you have. So, like, I'd love to hear your thoughts, like, if you have actual stories from organizations you've worked with of, like, how do you authentically start to build those new relationships with communities that you may have been ignoring up until now?
I think it really starts with your mission, your core mission and values. And is there like natural alignment with certain communities, or is there a certain program or services offered by your organization that naturally align to a particular demographic that you've never really cultivated from a potential fundraising perspective? But the relationships, I think, have to be authentic. I know at my time at Heart and Stroke, for example, there were four priority communities that we identified because of their higher than average incidence of heart disease and stroke. And so we had a really intentional strategy around working with Indigenous communities, Black communities, East Asian communities, and South Asian communities. And that came from a mission perspective. You have to invest before you start thinking, okay, now it's time to start fundraising. But I think the other thing that we also said was, how do you actually measure the health of your relationships? And so how do you not put those dollar values and fundraising goals on folks to say, you know, if you're going to invest time in XYZ community, we need to see you raise X amount of dollars in order for that investment to continue. The reality is relationship building takes a very long time. And fundraising is often about the short-term gains and results. And so if you want to make this an intentional strategy, we say like, A, build it into your performance management plans for all staff so that everyone's accountable. So not just the what they're doing, but how they're doing it, the kinds of relationships, the quality of relationships, the depth of relationships, and building those authentic community-based partnerships. And then two, removing all fundraising metrics from those relationships, because as soon as you layer those on, it becomes immediately about transaction. Who can you close? How quickly can you close? And so, you know, don't give maybe one person in your organization the responsibility of cultivating new audiences or new communities. Have everyone responsible for building in new relationships into their portfolio with no expectation of fundraising. That way, you know, they're still responsible for fundraising, but there's a part of their portfolio that's really just about genuine relationship building with no expectation that it's going to result in a five-figure gift in any amount of time, or six-figure gift, or seven-figure gift. So I think that's certainly a way that's very practical that I've seen done in a lot of great organizations, particularly healthcare organizations that have a strong alignment with communities based on their mission and that community's like incidence of that particular disease or health issue. But I think coming in from the mindset of I hear that there's money in this community, or we need to cultivate this community because they're giving a lot to their own organizations, but they're not giving to our hospital or our charity, is going to be the wrong approach. People smell that from a mile away, and you can dress it up as a Diwali celebration or an Eid gala or X, Y, and Z, but people do smell that. Like, just because you slap on a cultural holiday label on a gala does not make it authentic relationship building.
Yeah. And Maria, do you find, I know you have a lot of expertise in the education, like university world, you have a different lens coming from that space?
I don't know about a different lens, but I would say, so let's use higher education as an example. I think that, so we have to recognize two things. We have to recognize that the fundraising profession, particularly the leadership level, and the business of philanthropy, particularly in the United States and Canada, I would say North America and the Western model, is fundamentally based on the concept of trust. And trust is one that's expected because we've been a very homogenous community for a very long time. And it's this whole idea that if we can find one point of intersection between us, so like we're both human, we both went to the same university or something, then all of a sudden we make a whole bunch of assumptions that people should trust us. So like, if you think about the concept that, you know, we sent out development officers to go and visit complete strangers in their homes, and we just assume that everyone's going to trust each other, and that's like a totally normal thing. But if you take a step back and you think about it in our personal lives, how often would you go into a complete stranger's home for no, you know, that you'd never met before and you've had two email exchanges with, right?
Never. I would never do that.
Right. So when it comes to building authentic relationships with communities, I think we really need to examine how we go about building trust and how many assumptions we make about the trust that we can invoke in certain communities already and not take any of it for granted. I think we sort of have always, and I mean, I feel it too, like I went to university and, you know, if I meet someone who went to the same university, I'm sure in 5 minutes we can come up with like the bar that we both attended at some point, right? And it's okay to have these bonds, but we should not take them for granted because not everyone's experiences in those universities has been the same. Not everyone's, you know, memories and how they connected with the community has been the same. And I think that a lot of leaders sort of assume that there's trust in the community because they represent a reputable organization and it should just be there because it's always been there. But it's always been there because we've always approached the same community that kind of is the same circle of 10, 20 people. So if we're going to do this and expand, I think we need to really examine how deep we can build trust and how we go about it.
Yeah.
Mm, I love that.
And I think that gets to the other point of our article and the theme that, you know, Maria and I have been kind of examining over the last year, which is around this idea of democratization. And so, like, you know, not only are you thinking about building relationships with folks that you haven't necessarily had deep connections with in the past, but how are you actually enabling folks across the spectrum of giving to have influence and opportunity to engage with your organization? And so when we think about diversification and then democratization, if you look at the top and those principal donors, those tend to look, you know, like the you know, the typical kind of person from the majority of population. And so if you're thinking about diversification, thinking about what opportunities there are for folks who are giving at that annual or leadership level to have influence, that's a clear way of showing democracy, transparency, and building that trust. And I think that as organizations, we tend to give folks the most amount of influence who give the biggest gifts. And those biggest gifts often are the most highly designated and do not go towards operational expenses. And then you have the folks at the bottom who give to greatest need and they check off those that direct mail piece and they give it. Give without expectation of where that's going to go. They don't get stewardship reports. They don't get impact reports. They don't get to meet with the CEO or the VP of research, and they trust your organization. But how much trust have you allowed yourself to put in them? How much opportunity have you allowed them to influence your organization, where their gift goes, and how they can be more deeply engaged with the organization? And I'm not saying all of those folks are going to turn into principal donors, but if you're building some equity in terms of influence across the giving levels, there's greater opportunity for diversification at that higher level of principal giving or a major giving level.
Yeah. And yeah. One thing that I think is, like, I've loved to see the two of you and what you've been writing and talking about is that it's like a very holistic view, because you're talking about donors and then you're also talking about the team, right? Because it's like, the only way that we're going to change the nonprofit sector is to change, like, who is participating. So we sort of want to give people some tangible things that they can do, like how do we do a better job when we're actually hiring, and then also to retain staff. So love your thoughts on that.
And I'd actually love, if I can, to just piggyback just one more take on the question. Yes, anding Janice, what are you seeing that's working? You know, if you're seeing some organizations, like, please add some examples of, you know, what you're seeing that's really going well.
Okay. Well, I work in talent recruitment, particularly exclusively in the nonprofit sector. So I do all that kind of work all the time. And so a couple of things that I've noticed, right? There has definitely been a desire to hire candidates with a variety of lived experiences and backgrounds that are more representative of the communities that organizations serve. Whether all of that is sort of well thought out and genuine, or whether that's sort of the, you know, trendy, there could be a bit of a debate. But when I work with clients that would come to me and say something along the lines of, well, we would like a person of color in this position, you know, let's pick a director development. Our team is not very diverse at the leadership level. That's a very typical one. The immediate question I ask back is, okay, and then so what is your organization doing to create a more inclusive work environment? So if we were to be successful in finding you a person of color for this particular role, how supported are they going to be internally? How well, trained and educated is everyone in the organization to ensure, and sort of, are they going to be the only person, the first person? Are they going to be tokenized? So we have to have these conversations ahead of time before we get to the point of just thinking about you know, hiring someone, and that will automatically solve all of the problems, whatever that might be. But on the other side, I think there's also some very practical things that can be done at the hiring level that are working. So one example I can give you, I was working with a client a couple of months ago that, based on the sort of the mission that they had, there was a ton of typical, somewhat experienced white women who applied for the role. It was a women's health rights organization, so it totally made sense. And so me as a recruiter, in 2 weeks, I had a ton of very extremely qualified candidates I could have chosen from. And I could have said, here's 10 candidates, you know, just take your pick. My work here is done. But what I realized is that slate of candidates was not very representative. It was not diverse in its entirety. And the organization itself was servicing communities that were not represented in this fundraising pool. So I actually had to go out of my way and make sure that I was exclusively reaching out to different kinds of people to ensure that when the slate was eventually presented to the hiring committee, they had a lot more to choose from than just the typical fundraiser. And I think a lot of times, on the hiring side in the nonprofit sector, we're very reactive. So like, we would let a job like stay vacant for 2-3 months, and then all of a sudden we are hiring in a crisis, as I like to call it. And what happens is you have like the HR person that hires for your finance team and the admin team and the fundraising team, and everybody else is just putting the job out there and hoping someone will apply, and they're kind of shortlisting candidates and they show them to you and they're like, well, that's just who applied. There just isn't any people of color who are qualified for this role, right? And if you're the type of leader who is in a crisis and just trying to fill a role, you could potentially say, okay, well, you know, this is what it is. We just are struggling. There just isn't any, right? But the practical thing that is working is to stop there and think, okay, well, how could we have done this differently? And then the last thing I'm going to say, because I could talk about this for hours, but I don't think it's that interesting, is there is a very big difference. And Tanya and I did a training for an organization, and one of the topics was around talent recruitment. And it took, in preparation for this, it took me 5 minutes to go on a typical nonprofit job board and pull out two job descriptions, one of which had clear call-in language that was identifying that where the organization was in terms of their EDI strategy, why the type that kind of person would be beneficial to their team and how they would be supported. And another organization that had the last line of their job description says, we're an equal opportunity employer. Everyone is encouraged to apply. No phone calls, please. And so there's tiny little things like this that don't cost any money. It's not a ton of training to be able to do that are actually working, because that's a signal that you're sending to people. But there's a ton that we can do in hiring, I think, that can be done. I'm currently working with an organization in the United States whose entire job is to convince organizations to consider removing the university requirement as a minimum job requirement from jobs that don't actually require that, because there's tons of people who are perfectly skilled to do that work without it. And their research shows that, you know, 80% of what refer to as skill through alternative routes individuals are actually people of color. So if we wanted to diversify in a very simple way, you know, we are, by just putting a university degree as a requirement for an entry-level job of development officer, for example, we're automatically excluding a pool of people that is actually quite racialized. So it's little things like this, I think, that are actually going to make a difference over time, instead of just trying to find a unicorn or a needle in a haystack and like just obsessing over one particular role. Tanya, I don't know, I just went on a little bit of a tangent here.
Well,
a tangent.
I mean, it was a good tangent. And I think, you know, sometimes it helps to sort of break it down to more of an individual level. So when I think about the folks that I've hired throughout the years, you know, the ones that are just really skilled at, you know, making that ask and closing gifts, you know, you often think, okay, how do I set this person up for greater success, more scope of responsibilities? And you start thinking about your high performers and what you're going to do to help advance their career. Like, you're all in and investing in them. And I think that we need to sort of expand our understanding of the barriers for folks who have not been as successful, and to think about how do we actually look at the people that are so great at building authentic relationships that can bring that EDI lens, that understand the nuances of working in different ethnocultural communities, and how do we start valuing that and providing that that sort of leadership journey for them in the organization? How do we mentor and sponsor them to ensure that they actually stay? Because I think that, you know, one thing we did mention is we don't think there's a talent pipeline issue. The pipeline gets severed. People come into our sector, they don't see anyone that looks like them at the top. The cultural norms and values of our organizations are reflective of the dominant culture. And the expectation around how they build relationships is, again, based on cultural values held by the majority, who are white, cisgender generally. And so then they opt out because they don't feel like they fit in, they don't see pathways for success, and they don't see anyone that looks like them that's in a position to mentor and support them. And so I think what we really need to do is actually retain that pipeline by thinking about them as our high performers. And what would you do for your high performers that can close gifts? What would you do for your high performers that can close gifts, but also bring this like extra layer of understanding of community? And so I think that's really important, that we remember that on an individual level, and then remind ourselves of the barriers that some folks have. Like, the reality is that we all like to think about the hardships that we've endured in our careers to get where we are, but they're not the same as someone who has a visible identity that they can't hide. There's a lot of biases against folks. Train yourself to add as much objectivity to your recruitment and talent retaining strategies, but also to re-examine your unconscious bias frequently, because the fact of the matter is that we're humans and we're people, and we're making decisions about hiring and retaining talent, and those are based on our lived and professional experiences, and within those are biases that we don't often examine. So I think we have a responsibility to do that work and to surround ourselves with people that actually will call us out. You know, like, call out culture is good if it's in a safe way and you don't feel like you're going to lose your job over it. Mm-hmm. And so if you have people in your organizations that have a really unique lens and are not afraid to challenge your point of view, make sure they're in those decision-making interviews with you. Make sure that they're the ones saying, well, you said that you don't think that they're going to be a good fit for our organization. Let's test that out. Is that really like about their qualifications and their values, or is it about something that you don't like, that you haven't really thought about, is actually a bias? It's not like that they couldn't fit in the organization. So make sure you surround yourself with not the yes people and not the people that are the most like you, but the people that are least like you, that are going to bring a different perspective and challenge you.
Yeah. So let's get people into action. Let's give people something tangible that they can do. You know, like I said, we're people listening to this podcast, they work in the nonprofit space, they're leaders, and they're obviously interested. So that's good. If you've made it this far, care about this topic.
Yes. So, and you can pick, but I'd love to also just invite you possibly to talk about it. And you talked about it in your blog. You know, you both are so wise, and I've loved all of your suggestions and the forward facing how to do this work. But circling back to the place of fear, I think the people that I talk to, you know, they are afraid of losing or alienating their donors. And I think for them to be able to act, they maybe could use some strategies there as well. But that's just an invitation. You should give whatever counsel you want.
Okay, well, I'll go there.
Okay, thank you.
So I think with fear, I think it's important to realize that the majority of it is in our heads. And if you are the type of leader who's currently afraid of alienating your donors, it's very easy. I get it, because when you start working in major gifts or you're in a leadership position, you actually don't interact with a very limited amount of people with frequently that have a lot of influence. So your basis for why you think something would happen is based on, you know, the chair of the board saying something, for example, but they also happen to be a $100,000 donor. So you're thinking that's how all of their peers also think. So on a level, I think we also need to recognize that we have to give donors some credit. There's actually a lot of white established philanthropists who are doing a lot of work, and they're interested in seeing and supporting organizations that are looking to be more inclusive and to diversifying their donor base and serving the communities that they work with better. So I think that there's a lot there that we can lean into. It's not as scary as it might sound. There's actually a lot of donors who are going to be just fine. But the other reality that's really important to me is, you know, things are changing, generations are changing. If you're not paying attention to this today, you're not going to have any donors to work with tomorrow. And I mean tomorrow as in 5 or 10 years. So if that's the case, I think that it's not just a matter of are you sacrificing alienating the donors of today for the sake of alienating the donors of tomorrow? I think that's a question that leaders might want to ask themselves. And then think about the opportunity here. There's like, we have historically been alienating entire communities from the philanthropy. So if we're actually able to call in some of them, the opportunity there, I think, is much greater. And any potential alienation you might have could totally be offset by the amount of people that would come on board to support your organization if you do this kind of work authentically. So that's the other piece that I would say. But I would leave it with, like, if you had to do one action, the place that I am most passionate about is around talent recruitment. And my takeaway action would be, have a serious look at the sort of the shortlist and the applications that you're getting for the jobs that you're recruiting for, since a lot of organizations are looking to staff back up after the pandemic. And think about, you know, ask the question, you know, do the hard work of actually making sure that the people you're looking at don't all look the same.
Yeah, I remember I was listening to this podcast a little while ago, and they were talking about marketing, but I love they used this. They were like, who's not at the table? Like, yeah. And just keep asking that question, like, who's not here? Who's not here? Who's not here? And it's like, you know, the only way to change is to actually have different people sit around the table. So so we have to wrap up. I know we could go on for hours, but I know people are going to want to follow you and read everything you've, not just what you've written for us, but what you've written other places and listen to you at other podcasts. So what's the best place for people to reach out to the two of you?
LinkedIn is our jam. You can find me at Tanya Hannah Rumble. I'm the only one in the world with that full name. So yeah, connect, follow, and reach out if you want to engage in this conversation. This is a deep area of passion for both of us. And I think that the collective wisdom and the experience of others enriches our own wisdom and experiences. So we're on a continuous learning journey. So we love to learn from others. So share what you're doing that's working to democratize and diversify our fundraising leadership and our fundraising community.
Yeah, great. And we will link to, we'll put links in the show notes to LinkedIn for both of you so people can reach out. And thank you so much. You know, I've so enjoyed seeing the two of you out there, and I hope more people join you. You know, I hope we can support you in joining you in these conversations, because sometimes I look at how much the two of you are doing and I'm like, they must be very tired. Because they are really out there doing a lot. So thank you so much for, you know, and Maria, again, the repeat guest. So we always appreciate our repeat guests. And so we're gonna invite you to try that, like both things, like get over the fear and realize that there's more potential than there is things to be scared of. Like that's the scarcity, you know, don't be in scarcity, be in abundance. And then also to really ask that question of like, why am I not seeing the candidates that I need to see when I'm hiring and go out and look for them. So we're going to wrap up by asking you to subscribe if you haven't already to the podcast. And also we have a new feature, which is if you want to help us support the show, we love bringing you the show and there's costs associated with the show. And so if you can give us a little annual or monthly support, that would be great for the show. And the show is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership, where we provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. And we have a special resource this week. Margaret and I in August on the 11th at noon Eastern are going to lead a free conversation. We call them brilliant conversations. It's just a conversation with whoever shows up. And we're going to be looking at one chapter in particular from Kim Scott's new book, Just Work, which is about being an ally. So if you like this conversation, come and join us. And we want to hear all viewpoints. If you like the book, you hated the book, you didn't read the book, we don't care. Every voice is welcome. And so we're looking forward to that. And we'll link to that in the show notes. You can sign up and join us. So thanks, Tanya and Maria.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for coming and sharing your wisdom with us and our community.
So go put it into practice.